Welcome to CoCurious, where sacred learning and financial traditions come to be reinvented so that wisdom and money don't compete. My name is David McLean, and we're powered by learningadvisory.com. The descriptor for CoCurious is a podcast where sacred learning and financial traditions come to be reinvented so that wisdom and money don't compete. And I'm particularly excited about the conversation with Lance Katz, because Lance is both an actuary and the group CEO of the South African College of Applied Psychology, which is best known as SACAP. When you think of the relationship, and particularly the intersection of pedagogy and profit, what are the things that are most pertinent to you in that relationship?
David, it actually goes to the core of our business model. When I got involved with SACAP in 2010, this question was something that I was very cognizant we would need to navigate. I was mindful then that I was stepping into the shoes of my predecessor, Mark Feitelberg, who had started the college and who had a strong academic and psychological background, that I was coming at the space from a business perspective. And I remember my very first graduation that I attended for SACAP and just being struck by the importance of that occasion, not only in terms of the academic significance of it, but that our graduates coming up and walking the stage to collect their certificates, they would need to put those certificates up on their wall, and those certificates would need to last a very, very long time in terms of credibility. And I felt immediately the weight of responsibility of heading up an academic institution, that this is not a business like any other business. This is an academic institution first and foremost. And academic rigor and credibility and reputation has to be the number one priority for what we're about. So if ever there was an occasion where I had a true sense of that, it was at that very first graduation that I attended in my new role. And I knew that we would need to navigate the potential tensions between the business aspect, the academic aspects, and then a third dimension, which is social impact. Most of my professional career, although it was in finance, was directed towards social impact areas, socially responsible investing. And so for me, SACAP was not just an academic institution, but very much dedicated at its core towards social impact and training practitioners to go out into the world of work and to make a big difference in community settings, in individual lives, and so on and so forth. And in fact, that was one of the reasons that I was drawn to getting involved in SACAP. So we developed what we called our social enterprise model, where we sort of visualized these three aspects as three circles that intersected. So each circle intersected with another circle, and that there was a point actually where all three circles intersected. What are those three circles? The business aspect, the academic aspect, and the social impact aspect. And what we've lived with since 2010 is the tensions and, in fact, the synergies between those three circles. You started with the question, the tension between finance and business and academics. But actually, if one has a longer term view of all of this, the two are very symbiotic. We're building our institution for the long term. We're not in the business of academics for a year or 2 years or 5 years. We're here for the long term. And the only way we're going to be able to do that is if we are investing back into our product, making sure that our academic institution is one of credibility and rigor and reputation. At the same time, for the institution to be sustainable, we need to be viable, financially viable. In some people's minds, there's a tension between those two, and sometimes there are real tensions between the two. In reality, they actually lived quite symbiotically together, and that's the way we've always run SACAP. We've always had voices from the academic side, from the business side, and those that are very motivated by the social impact side. All of those voices are present in all the decisions that we make, and we make decisions collaboratively and, for the most part, by consensus.
That last part is the essence of it, isn't it? Oftentimes, fault lines are symptomatic of a lack of collaboration and a lack of consensus. Conflicts are fascinating in how they manifest, because whether they're between nations or individuals, so often the position, the rightness, the superiority is a mirror image of the position held by group or individual Y. The addition of the social impact component is easy to talk about and pay lip service to, just like diversity, equity, and inclusion. If you look at the websites of most organizations who have reference to DEI, almost without exception, it's speaking about values held, position on what we stand for and what we're going to do, but very, very little about what we've done, what we've learned by the doing, and how that influences our current practice and our future aspirations for advancement.
A few thoughts are sparked by what you're saying. When I worked in the corporate world, I came across this notion of purpose-driven. I tried to implement it. You know, I remember sitting with my team when I was heading up a investment banking operation for a large financial services organization and saying to my team, you know, but let's get to the real purpose of what we're doing. Let's talk about the why. It was an almost impossible conversation, because although corporates more and more are trying to find this why or define this why, it's more aspirational than it is real, and it seldom resonates authentically. A lot of corporates talk about win-win, but in reality, most of the behavior is win-lose. Very seldom is there a real commitment to win-win outcomes. So people talk win-win, but the actions, the practice is a win-lose mindset. You know, we have to win at the expense of somebody else. When I joined SACAP, it was so refreshing because I kind of had the same conversation again with my team, and there was no resistance to this at all. It was completely natural, because every single person that was part of SACAP was there for the purpose of the institution. They were motivated by our commitment to training the practitioners that could go out and make a difference in mental health in South Africa. And that was the whole rationale for the college in the first place. I think when Mark Feitelberg started the college, he didn't imagine himself building a large business. He was trying to address a specific need in community psychology that just wasn't being addressed by the universities. You raise a very interesting point here, is that too often these lofty aspirations of social impact or purpose or values are actually more aspirational than they are real. That's where they trip up. For example, a lot of organizations talk about values, but the values that they have as their organization aren't actually their values. They're the values they want to have, but not actually the values that the organization reflects. I think you're touching on a very interesting point, and it's something we've been very conscious of in our context, is to be authentic to all three of those circles and to give voice to them, to recognize the potential tensions, to seek symbiotic aspects to them, and to see the tension as something that's healthy fundamentally, and not something to be squashed or silenced, but rather a healthy tension that actually makes us a stronger and better institution.
The difference between espoused and enacted values, we're judged individually and we judge others and organizations based on what is enacted. What is the greatest unlearning you've had at SACAP relative to your worldview in corporate finance before you came to SACAP?
I came into SACAP having had a fairly torrid time managing people. And I had an assumption of myself that I was not a good people manager. I was a good strategist, but that people management was sort of above my pay grade and that I would have to outsource that to others. My unlearning around that is I had the benefit of learning from, I consider her to be one of the best people managers I've ever come across, and that there's certain basic processes to people management that can make a poor manager or someone who thinks of themselves as a poor manager or a mediocre manager actually quite an effective manager. And I'll give you a small example of that that I learned from Zarina, who's our managing director and the person I'm referencing here. Zarina taught me the value of the one-on-one, regular one-on-ones with your direct reports. in previous roles, I always had these sort of meetings that I had maybe once a month with my direct reports, but I never took them terribly seriously. You know, if they happened, they happened. If we were busy with other things or if there was something more important, we'd set it up another time, we'd leave another month, we'd come back together. And, you know, it was very, very ad hoc. And Zarina taught me the value of this regular one-on-one that you just don't cancel. What I mean by regular is weekly, not monthly, a weekly direct one-on-one conversation with your direct report. And just the value of that learning dramatically improved my effectiveness as a manager. In financial services, you can get away with a lot because the numbers are big and the margins are substantial. And you can get away with not paying too much attention to the detail from a people perspective. But in an environment where there's like ours, where there's lots of moving parts and it's very much about people, there's no place to hide. I guess my great unlearning, so to speak, has been that actually I can be an effective people manager by just being disciplined about making time for the people that I'm responsible for leading and interacting with on a regular basis and really paying attention to those small things that actually add up over time and make a very, very, very big difference.
It's a shift in core belief is what I'm hearing, and an awakening of management of self as much as the leading of others. So if we bring it back to the present, if you were appointed the Minister of Higher Education in South Africa, and your term is only 24 months, what one practical thing would you focus on to advance teaching and learning in a distracted, budget-stretched world?
David, that's a big topic. A lot of the areas that need to be addressed in that space are less in the regulatory environment and more in the operational environment of the academic institutions themselves and how they go about teaching and learning, their strategies for the future, making sure that their institutions are accessible, high quality, that they're adapting to new technologies, using them efficiently and effectively, and creating graduates for the world of work and the world that's constantly changing. And if I can pick on one thing, because you've asked for one practical thing, there's something that really bothers me about the higher education regulatory environment in South Africa, which stands in contrast. A good example would be the Australian model. In Australia, you cannot get a 3-year degree accredited with their regulatory authority unless there are early exit points in your qualification that give the learner the opportunity to acquire a lesser qualification if they exit after 1 or 2 years. So if they exit after 1 year, they can get a such and such a qualification. If they exit after 2 years, they can get a diploma. If they exit after 3 years, the full term, they get their degree. You can't get your qualification accredited in Australia unless you provide these early exit options. South Africa has the opposite. The South African regulations say you cannot issue a lesser qualification for an early exit of somebody from a greater qualification. So if someone signs up for a degree and they only complete the first year of the degree, they exit with nothing. You are not allowed as an educational institution in South Africa to issue them with a higher certificate for having completed the year, or to issue them with a diploma for having completed 2 years. In fact, the regulators here encourage you to have those qualifications very different from one another, precisely so that you cannot have these early exits possibilities. Now, the irony here is that in South Africa, we have a greater need for the Australian regulation than the Australians do, because Australia is first world. People can afford, they have lower dropout rates. And in general, people complete the qualifications they start with. Our problem in higher education in South Africa is firstly, people cannot afford. So a lot of the attrition that you see in higher education is because people simply cannot afford to continue with their qualifications for the time that they set out, or because of academic challenges or other life challenges. They start out with a degree, but they simply aren't able to do it. And what better way for us to get people with qualifications and get people moving into the higher education space than to actually make it possible for them to exit early if they need to for whatever reason and get a qualification. If you've got somebody, a family or an individual who have so little financial wherewithal at their disposal, and they put so much of that into their education, and then after a year and a half of a degree, they simply can't afford to keep going, for them to walk away with nothing is a travesty. And yet our regulations continue to reinforce this at the most fundamental. It's draconian and it's counterproductive. So if I was the Minister of Higher Education for 24 months, and I wouldn't need hopefully 24 months to do this, I would change that regulation as my first step, because it really is something that South Africa should be doing. And if ever there's a country that needs to be doing that, it's our country.
As you can see, I'm nodding almost so my head rolls off my shoulders. Some organizations stack a higher certificate, advanced certificate, and then an advanced diploma to get somebody to the equivalent of a bachelor degree. It's still not called a bachelor degree, albeit that one does wind up with three discrete qualifications. That allows people to earn and learn in unison.
But even there, regulations are very, very draconian. They don't like stacking. And they actively avoid. So we had for a while, we had our diploma, which was a 2-year qualification, was like the first 2 years of our degree. So if you registered for the diploma, we couldn't have the early exit options because the regulations don't allow that. But we had, if you did our diploma and graduated with that, you could then move into the third year of our degree. You can no longer do that. That stacking has been actively discouraged. And at the very least, you're going to have to do at least another 6 months of learning. So the most you'll be able to sort of get for your diploma is maybe a year to year and a half of the degree, even after 2 years of studying, and then have to do more, which once again makes it much more expensive for learners to upgrade their qualifications and to take them to a higher level. The same with the higher certificate. You know, the higher certificate used to be the first year of our degree. We had to change that to comply with the regulations. And that makes it much more expensive for students to move and articulate. So the framework claims to be in favor of and supportive of articulation, but actually it's quite counterproductive as it's structured at the moment. And I think we could do work here. I think the regulators are well-intentioned, but we could do work here at a regulatory level to really streamline our articulation processes and to address some of these very real affordability and exit issues that exist in the South African higher education context.
I would love to be a part of mobilizing something like that. I suspect that it's probably been discussed at the ministerial level before, but there's no harm in rejuvenating it. I'm really excited to hear if you can give us some meat on the bone here for the operational environment because of holding patternism, where we can't do anything until the regulations change. And I'm always of the view is the regulations change slowly. Tell us more about the operational environment. What does that mean? What can we do? What can we focus on specifically in our institutions to advance learning in a distracted and budget-stretched world?
You know, when you shared your topic with me, David, I deconstructed it. Smarter learning, distracted, budget-stretched world. Let's start with distracted because that's all of us actually. It just shows how technology is impacting on us. For most of us in this distracted world, we've become slaves to the technology. We need to empower ourselves again to make selective choices about when we use the technology, how we use the technology, and for what purpose. Conscious and discerning and disciplined around it. And creating technology-free days. I keep Shabbat. It's a technology-free day. It's a wonderful 24 hours where the cell phone's off, there's no telephone calls, there's no distraction. As academic institutions, to bring it back to your question about what do we do operationally or inside the institution, is to inculcate some of these disciplines in our students, how to become conscious learners, how to be discerning in the use of technology, information, to be more critical thinkers, do certain things on their own without using technology to assist, but also not to be afraid of technology and to use technology in an empowering way. What's interesting at the moment, of course, is this whole discussion about AI, because different institutions are having different responses to it. We've embraced AI. We've obviously made our students aware of what would be considered abuse of AI and what would be considered responsible use of AI. And we're encouraging our students to do that, to focus also on human interaction and empathy and all critical skills that are essential to actually building a more robust approach towards living in the world and not being a distracted person, but actually a more empowered, self-aware individual. Those are key things that higher education institutions can and should be doing in terms of addressing the distracted aspects.
What you're speaking to are behaviors and a consciousness agnostic of medium, elevating as a continuum one's expanse of consciousness, a situational awareness. And the example that I use is that on the flight deck of modern aircraft that are unbelievably sophisticated and layers of backup, the flight deck still has windows through, 250 degrees to have a combination of reality and digital, and to also look outside and see what's actually happening. My endeavor is to expand the depth and breadth of my flight deck's window. Something that is in my consciousness all the time is that I'm still the responsible steward of whatever output I put into the world. At its base level, medium doesn't change behavior. So if I'm sloppy, I'm going to put in a vanilla prompt and I'll copy and paste the output and move on. If I have higher degrees of consciousness and discernment, the likelihood of me crafting before I put anything into the Gen AI engine, then it's a symbiotic prompt engineering relationship between me and the engine, as opposed to me just being the prompter at the initial input. And then it's an iterative thing, whether I'm using a digital environment or whether I'm having a conversation with Lance Katz around a coffee table.
Absolutely. The employers are already way ahead of that game. The employers are looking for graduates that are using AI and debugging, prompting AI, debugging AI, and they're interested in what experience you have. And sometimes that disconnect between the world of work and the world of education is a problem. So, and that leads nicely to another aspect of this, which is this budget-stretched world, is to make sure that we're producing graduates that are employable, and to make sure that they are developing the relevant skills for not only today's employment environment, but for what's likely to be in the future. Some of those skills are not necessarily hard skills, because the hard skills that are needed are changing all the time. It's in the soft skills space that we need to be really developing our graduates as well, so that they are adaptable, they are curious, to use the name of your podcast, co-curious, you know, curiosity, creativity, adaptability, durability, and also making sure that the academic environment is reflective of what's going on in the real world as well. It addresses something fundamental around budget stretched. You know, the only way we're going to really successfully build our country is by really creating employment opportunity and graduates that are able to take those opportunities and make something of it. It's a global village. We've got to make sure that our graduates are globally competitive. You know, where you work and where you live are no longer the same place. And then I think we've got to bring down the cost of education in real terms. And I'm hoping that the technologies will enable us to do that without taking away employment opportunities for those that work behind our institutions and work inside our institutions. There's a lot that can be done to actually deliver better value qualification at a lower cost, using technology as a key enabler and key driver.